Okay, all right, great, thank you. Welcome, and I'm glad you made it. I know traffic was terrible. It took me 40 minutes to get here, and it usually takes me 12, so. And thank you for coming. I wish I could tell you there was a way to approach this chapter without getting into the minutiae of ancient history. But if you thought my lesson on Daniel 7 was too dry or technical, you're going to be disappointed with this teaching. If you liked the controversial interpretations of chapter 7, then you will really like this chapter. The whole chapter, I really hope you've read it ahead of time, because I'm going to have to kind of pound through it here. The whole chapter is an angel speaking to Daniel about the future. There are no strange creatures here. There are no trees growing to heaven to help us visualize what's happening. It all happens in terms of talking about prophecies, about times that are coming in the future. And things get pretty complicated pretty quickly, and sometimes they even get beyond the ability of human language to translate this prophecy into concrete terms. But if there's one thing and only one thing that you remember about Daniel 11, it is that God is in control of human history. He is in control of all parts of human history, including the scary, the violent, the chaotic parts. And even when it looks like no one is in control, God is in control. And everything goes according to his plan. And as James Boyce pointed out, this long and detailed and thus important prophecy must be significant for God's people to understand, or it would not have been included in the Bible. Okay, we've seen this, I know, several times before. I just wanted to bring it up to refresh your memories about it. The things that Tremper Longman told us that we would find in Daniel's visions to a greater or lesser extent. Now, chapter 11 is smack in the middle of the extended narrative between chapters 10 and 12. We're not going to see all of these points today, and I'm not going to go through them again. You can refresh your memory by being on the screen. But do keep them in mind when you are thinking about the entire vision. Today I'm going to break up the chapter into four parts. Well, it's not like a Monty Python routine here, but four parts. The struggle between Persia and Greece, that's going to be verses 2 to 4. The struggle between the kings of the north and the kings of the south, that's verses 5 through 20. The ascendancy of the king of the north, that's verses 21 through 35. And the blasphemous ruler, verses 36 to 45. We've briefly seen part of this vision before. That is, Daniel has been granted part of this vision before in chapters 7 and 8. But here the beasts and their actions are going to be fleshed out in ways that we can track very closely to accounts that are outside of the Bible, which is very reassuring. But sometimes the specifics that the angel is talking about, we can't track. And I'm going to bring up a few of them. But I want to emphasize that the history that is being related in this chapter is mostly clear and is telling about events that allow us to, as I said, track very closely with extra-biblical sources or non-biblical sources, and so we can understand what it is that the angel is saying to Daniel. In fact, if you really like reading about this, Calvin wrote 40 pages about the history from this chapter alone and how it fits with the prophecy. And he was most definitely not the only one to do this. There was one commentary I picked up that had about 40 pages as well. I'm not going to do that to you. but I'm going to give you a for instance, so you can kind of understand why I'm saying that these things are meshed. The second part of verse 6 in the New Living Translation says, some years later, an alliance will be formed between the king of the north and the king of the south. The daughter of the king of the south will be given in marriage to the king of the north to secure the alliance, but she will lose her influence over him, and so will her father. She will be abandoned along with her supporters. Now, we know from Greek that is, secular or non-biblical sources, historians, that tell us about events around 250 BC. There's a king named Ptolemy II, who was the king of the south. He was king of Egypt. And he made a marriage alliance with Antiochus II, who was king of the north, because he's ruling up in around modern-day Syria. And he, as normal in the ancient world, that you cement these political alliances by giving a king your daughter in marriage. And that's exactly what Ptolemy II did. He gives him his daughter Berenike. In order to make this alliance, Antiochus had to first divorce his wife. He was married at the time. And he had to disinherit two sons that he had with her. If you can imagine doing that to your own children. Berenike did get married to Antiochus. They had a son together. This was the point of the alliance, to have a ruler that could rule both lands. But when the son was 2 years old, Berenike's father died. And Antiochus decided, okay, that's the end of the alliance. If he's not in power anymore, there's no way that I can make sure that my son gets to sit on the throne. So he left Berenike and goes back to his first wife. You can see how closely this tracks with verse 6 that I have up there. Now I'll give you the second part of it. Sadly, Berenike's son, Berenike herself, were poisoned by Antiochus' first wife to make sure that there was no struggle over the throne. But you may feel a little relief, I don't know, depending on how vengeful you are, to know that this first wife also poisoned Antiochus to make sure that he didn't interfere with her plans either to put her sons on the throne. Me, I'm just waiting for the BBC America series to come out, because that's really what it sounds like. But since the verses in Daniel's vision are so closely matched to events that, as I said, that we can pick up from other sources, there are Christian and Jewish writers who argue that the prophecy in Daniel 11 could not have been written before these things happened, because they are so close together, but it must have been written after the events occurred, and people already knew they were going to happen, so you could write them down as prophecy, probably in the 2nd century BC, or about 250 years after the lifetime of Daniel. As I said, both Jewish and Christian commentators have proposed this. These writers run into a problem at the end of chapter 11, when events suddenly and clearly move away from what happened on earth in the 2nd century BC. We end up with apocalyptic language again, just as we had in chapter 7. Remember, chapter 7 started in history and ends at the end times, and I believe that's what's happening here in chapter 11. But I wanted to warn you, in case you do any extra reading about Daniel, that you will run into this theory. And if you do any extra reading about Daniel 11 on the web, don't do it, it's scary. As you can imagine, in this day and age, there are a lot of people coming out and going to tell you exactly what's happening in Daniel 11. Just warning you. Again, there are Christian theologians who argue, again, that this is a 2nd century BC prophecy. Prophecy is not really a prophecy. But other Christian theologians point out that there is a hole that you can drive a truck through in this theory. And I agree with the latter. So I'm going to proceed by saying that the vision was written down in the 6th century BC. And as a result, there are some sections that we're not entirely clear what is happening. Imagine if an angel came to you and was describing to you what was going to happen in the next 400 years. Do you think every detail would be very clear to the people you're trying to communicate this to? But let's start in the easier part of the vision. Verses 2 through 4. It says there that there are going to be four kings of Persia, and then a mighty king who conquers the Persians. His empire, that is the mighty king's empire, will be broken up into four parts. The four kings of Persia are not easily identified because they're in fact 13. But the Greeks and the Persians start fighting each other in 480 BC, a fight that ends when Alexander the Great invades the area that was controlled by Persia in 336 BC, after which it only took him a few years, I think like 3 years, to conquer the Persians, and that's exactly why he's called the Mighty King. He dies, probably of liver failure, in 323 BC. He left no real heir. He only had a very small child. So the four generals of his army divide the empire and go to rule different parts of it. And this is the quiz that Sue promised you last week. As you can see, the different colors, I hope you can see that different colors show that it's divided up basically into four different kingdoms. But the only two that we are going to be worried about are the Seleucids, who are in the north. They're the green on the map, and if your sense of modern geography is such, you will understand that they hold a huge tract of territory, much of which is still being fought over today. They hold most of modern Turkey, Syria, Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, and parts of modern Pakistan. The founder of their line is named Seleucus, and his son's name is Antiochus. And so the names of the two, they keep being switched off, being stowed on later descendants, and so we, moderns, call them 1, 2, 3, and 4, but the ancients had to give them nicknames to keep them straight, and you'll hear one in a second. The king of the south, which is orange on the map, and by the way, I'm having to show you a map that just is a snapshot in time, so the borders will change depending on who's fighting with whom, and we will especially be seeing that right here on the map. It shows you that the Levant, that is modern-day Israel, is occupied by Ptolemy, the king of the south. That is not always true, but like I said, I just had to kind of pick a moment to give you a map to figure out kind of what's happening here. The king of the south was another Greek general. His name was Ptolemy, and all of his male descendants take his name. So we have the numberings and the nicknames going on here too. He takes over Egypt and parts of modern Libya. Right smack in between them, as I said, was the Levant, the beautiful land, as Daniel calls it. The Seleucids and the Ptolemies are going to fight for control of this area for 150 years in what are called the Six Syrian Wars. The Jews, who had been allowed to return to Jerusalem and Israel when these men were fighting, was then first ruled by the Persians, then by Alexander the Great, and then alternately by the Seleucids and the Ptolemies, depending on which era you're in. So you can understand why God would need to give the Jews this detailed prophecy so that they could understand he still loved his people, but he was using them to bring a blessing to the whole world, even if they were ruled by outside forces. Verses 5 through 20, the struggle, as I said, those were the easy verses. Now the verses 5 through 20, the struggle between the kings of the north and the kings of the south. And again, I do not want to go into detail here. As you saw from me just talking about the end of verse 6, many things in this passage can be accounted for by non-biblical historians, so our interpretation is fairly straightforward. Control of the beautiful land, as I said, passes between Seleucid and Ptolemaic kings, the kings of the north, the kings of the south. There are problems, of course. In verse 14b, it says, "The violent among your people will rouse themselves in order to establish the vision, but they will fail." Okay, who are these people? Well, it could refer to a Jewish revolt against the Ptolemies, who were taxing the province fearfully. But most commentators, including, which I think is really interesting, the early church fathers, who had a lot more at their fingertips than we did, are content with not really understanding this verse. Just kind of saying, okay, whatever, let's move on. But farther on, we begin to see that there is a cosmic battle that is being reflected in the historical rulers. There is always a cosmic battle between good and evil going on. In verse 16, the invader will do as he pleases. No one will be able to stand against him. He will establish himself in the beautiful land, and he will have power to destroy it. Imagine being a Jew and hearing this about the future leader of your area of the world. Commentators are agreed that this is Antiochus III, but notice that the same thing approximately was said about Alexander the Great and will be said again about the ruler in verse 36. That is, God is preparing the Jews by saying there's going to be a succession of kings who will not worship God, and they will triumph, at least temporarily. You can almost understand why Jews would go back to the Psalms, and I picked Asaph in writing in Psalm 73, for comfort. He writes, "For I was envious of the arrogant when I saw the prosperity of the wicked. They have no pangs until death. Their bodies are fat and sleek. They are not in trouble as others are. They are not stricken like the rest of mankind. Therefore, pride is their necklace. Violence covers them as a garment. Their eyes swell out through fatness. Their hearts overflow with follies. They scoff and speak with malice. Loftily they threaten oppression. They set their mouths against the heavens, and their tongue struts through the earth. They say, 'How can God know? Is there knowledge in the Most High?' Until I went to the sanctuary of God, and then I discerned their end. Truly you set them in slippery places. You make them fall into ruin. How they are destroyed in a moment, swept away utterly by terrors. The powerful look as if they're in control, but they're not. God has ordained their rise and fall, and sometimes the only way that we can remember that is by going into God's presence in prayer." In verses 5 through 20, we move through about 100 years of history, and then the angelic interpreter pauses in order that Daniel and the rest of the Jews can hear about a truly devastating ruler who foreshadows what will happen to the end of the world. What do we find out about this king in verses 21 through 35? Well, everything here matches the life and deeds of Antiochus IV, except there are a few obscure causes, I agree. But for the most part, Antiochus IV is named here. Now, he's a man. We don't know if he came up with it himself or he just kind of encouraged other people to come up with it. But his nickname was Epimanes. In Greek, that is translated as God made manifest. Marianne now showed you that put his that nickname, because he liked it so much, on his coins. So he adopted it as his own. His detractors actually preferred the name Epimanes, a pun on it, which means the madman. He is the little horn that you have already heard about in chapter 8. Antiochus was not supposed to be king. I'm going to tell you briefly how he fits into these verses. He was not supposed to be king, but he instigated a coup d'etat to depose the real king. His military successes against Egypt were real, even if we are not sure who the Prince of the Covenant was in verse 22. If you're reading the ESL study notes, there is a note that is more confident than other commentaries that I read that they can identify him. Some commentators suggest that this is a reference to the high priest in Jerusalem, because we know that Antiochus deposes one and it puts another one in place after he is given bribes by the Jewish claimant to the high priest throne. In verses 23 and 27, Antiochus is said to make and break alliances in order to obtain more wealth. Well, he did that with the high priest, but he will do it with other alliances as well. In his invasion of Egypt, he does succeed far beyond any other Seleucid king. So if you're going to be talking about a king who is very successful against the king of the south, this would be Antiochus IV. And we are told by Greek and Roman historians that he did divide the plunder with his army. He did partly to spur their loyalty to him, but partly to instigate them to plunder even more. God puts a temporary end to this in verse 24, and you're going to hear about how that happens in a second. But then Antiochus's greed is renewed in verses 25 through 27, and he returns to Egypt with his army. We do know that he captures Ptolemy VI, who plots with him to overthrow Ptolemy's own brother, who's Ptolemy the Eighth. I don't remember what happened to Ptolemy VII. He drops out somewhere early. But they are clearly, in verse 27, two brothers then that are deceiving each other. Antiochus withdraws on the orders of Rome, but the Ptolemies do reconcile, the two brothers reconcile, so Antiochus returns to Judea in a foul mood, ready to take out his frustrations on the Jews. And that's when we start hearing about what he is doing. Now the sequence of events in terms of what he, how he takes out these frustrations on the Jews and when exactly he does it is not entirely clear, but we do know that Antiochus does loot the temple, that is the temple of the God of Israel in Jerusalem, and he murders thousands of what he calls rebellious Jews, people who apparently did not like him as overlord for reasons that probably escaped him. But he doesn't stay long in Judea, because he decides that the two Ptolemies who are ruling in Egypt are also plotting against him. So he once again marches south with an army to plunder Egypt. So as I said, God stops him for a while, but he goes back into Egypt. When he arrives, he's met by a delegation which has sailed from Rome. And this is again in the prophecy, that's your translation probably says Kittim. Kittim in verse 30 means any lands that are west of Israel. But this delegation included high-ranking Roman officials. And one of them actually very brashly draws a line in the sand and tells Antiochus, you can either go over the line, which is where we get that from, and make war on Egypt, but which that would include he would make war on Rome, or you can turn around and go home. And he decides to go home. And when he returns, as you can imagine, the full force of his anger falls upon the Jews. So near the temple, he builds a fortress. Can you imagine? He builds a fort near the temple of God in Israel. And he wants this will keep an eye on things. This, by the way, will be refurbished by the Romans and will be the place where Jesus is whipped. We are told that he has decreed that the Jews are no longer allowed to perform the daily sacrifice. And he installs what Daniel calls the abomination of desolation. We're not exactly sure what that is. Perhaps he installed a statue to his god Zeus in the temple of the god of Israel. He again begins to round up and kill rebellious Jews. That's referred to again in verse 33. And these actions are actually described in books that are written in the 2nd century, the 1st and 2nd Maccabees. These actions set up, that is Antiochus's actions, set up what we call today the Maccabean Revolt. And this revolt will eventually drive the Seleucid rulers out of Palestine permanently. The Maccabean Revolt was not simply a revolt against Antiochus and his policies, however, because there were Jews who sided with Antiochus in his attempt to make the province, that is Israel, look more like its Greek neighbors. And they had the support of a high priest who had been appointed by Antiochus, which, as I said, replaced the one that the Jews themselves had put in place in accordance with what they knew of as God's will. So we think this is referred to in verses 33 through 35, but I'm going to warn you that verse 35 is especially controversial. The wise in that verse may refer to the Maccabees, who ultimately lead the ultimately successful revolt. But commentators are hesitant to endorse this because the interpretation would suggest that the Maccabean revolt was a holy war, although it was undertaken without any specific orders from God. So, as I said, we're not exactly sure what's going on there. We do hear from the angel that the wise will stumble as they executed the war. And we do know that the Maccabees committed atrocities such as killing fellow Jews who would not go to war with them or who would not practice their Judaism in a pure enough way. And by the way, this is also the period when a community of people who called themselves the Essenes withdrew to Qumran. And they would live apart from the temple. They said the high priest was corrupt. They would not be part of the temple worship. And they produced what you might know of as the Dead Sea Scrolls. Even so, it says in verse 35, the wise will become refined, purified, and cleansed until the time of the end, because the appointed time is still to come. Now, when we hear the appointed time, we usually think about that as referring to the end times or the last judgment. But I wonder if it also refers to the time of Jesus' birth and earthly ministry. I say this because the Maccabean revolt was only one symptom of many that the world was being prepared for Jesus' life on earth. We know that there was a longing for a Messiah that was reached fever pitch in the first century BC throughout the entire Mediterranean basin. We have already seen that the Greeks were calling their kings by nicknames like God with us. They would also refer to their rulers as Soter, or Savior. In the first century BC, the Romans began a series of devastating civil wars that tore apart their empire and led them to talk about their national sin. And sin is not a word that the Romans had ever used before this, and they would not use it again. It was not a concept at home at all in Rome. But they were looking for a leader, a specific leader, who was going to bring them back to the golden age when they could become sinless again. The Jews under the Maccabees split into factions, according to Josephus, an ancient historian that is explaining the Jews to the Romans. One of these factions you've heard of is called the Pharisees. And the Pharisees, I know we get a particular view of them through Jesus' teachings, but they started as being people, men who were intent on restoring religious purity to Israel with the stated goal, that is, they said, the reason why we're trying to get you guys kind of past this line is because we are preparing Israel for God's Messiah. And if Israel doesn't go over that line, if they're not prepared, God will not send his Messiah. Some groups, like the Essenes, felt that the Pharisees weren't even radical enough, and they, in their demands to obey the Torah and the law. So they got their own groups together with even more stringent restrictions to make sure that the true Israelites would not break the law and the Messiah would return. All over Israel, however, what you didn't even have to belong to the Pharisees or the Essenes, and archaeologists have found this in every place that they have gone in first century BC layers in Israel. People stopped using imported pottery, and they started using utensils made out of stone, things that they were made in Israel, cups, bowls. Because they felt that these vessels contributed more to ritual purity than the clay vessels they had. It would be as if you went into your house and threw away all of your dishes, all of your pots and pans, and replaced them in order to try to bring the Messiah back. In other words, it was during the terrible reign of Antiochus IV that God is putting into fourth gear his plans to prepare the entire world, Jew, Greek, and Roman, for the arrival of his son. And so when we turn to verse 36, there is a subtle shift in the language, leaving many commentators, but again, not all commentators, to think that a new person is being talked about. It may not even have been clear to Daniel that a new person is being talked about, but in verses 36 to 35, it gets harder to understand Antiochus as a person being talked about. I agree that the opening of verse 36 sounds like the angel is continuing to talk about Antiochus, because he's talking about the king, the king, the king. Verse 36 starts out, the king. Antiochus certainly did, if you start reading into that section a little bit, Antiochus did exalt himself and he made himself great. He was the first of the four kings of Diadox that ruled after Alexander the Great to call himself God manifest. He was the first one to equate himself with a god, Zeus. He blasphemed God. It is possible to read his contempt even for gods of his fathers by he turned slightly away from the Seleucid god Apollo for Zeus, but then we start running into trouble. We have no real idea who this god is that women love, that Antiochus is spurning, nor of the god of the fortresses or the foreign god that he honors. We just don't have that in any of the other sources, that he brings in some other god. That's in verses 38 and 39. And then in verses 40 to 45, this king that is being talked about wins a huge battle over Egypt and controls Libya and the Nubians. And this in no way fits what Antiochus accomplished. Finally, we do know from extra biblical sources again about the end of Antiochus's life. We are told by ancient authors that he did leave the beautiful land and go east to Persia, where his his capital was. And while he's in Persia, he loots a pagan temple because he badly needs money. He was unsuccessful in getting actually the money that he needed, but he was suddenly struck with madness and died in Persia. That is, he was not attacked by the king of the north and the king of the south, as these verses imply this king is going to be. Our Jewish sources say that he realized the real reason why he was dying was because he had looted the temple of God in Jerusalem. And one Jewish writer even tells us that he converted to Judaism on his deathbed. He wished that was so, but I don't know. A pagan Roman source lets us know that he was struck down because of divine displeasure. That is, they are in agreement that it was the gods that struck him down, but they would say that the god whose temple he was trying to loot in Persia had struck him down. But commentators who want to see Antiochus in verses 35 to 46 have a great deal of trouble explaining these last verses because they do not fit within Antiochus's life story. So let's try another solution. You knew there would be one, right? There are scholars, and this includes Calvin, who suggest that these verses refer to the time refer to what happens to the Jews during the Roman Empire. And this becomes understandable when we think back about the Ark of the Vision in chapter 7, which, if you believed one interpretation, was talking about the Roman Empire. So you didn't have to believe that, so maybe this isn't so much of an argument. But in order to make this argument, Calvin, for instance, has to argue that the king, who is mentioned in verse 36, should be thought of as the kingdom, or all of the emperors rolled into one, because there's no one emperor that fits all of these verses. The verses do make sense. It makes some sense that way, though, in terms of what happens in the Eastern Mediterranean during the Roman Empire. Certainly the emperors, who allow worship of themselves as gods, were more blasphemous than Antiochus, and that fits verse 36. We still have a problem with them rejecting the god of their fathers, that is not ever clear, and we still don't know who this god is desired by women whom they reject. You could call their Jupiter the god of the fortresses, since his temple is on the highest point in Rome, but that's not entirely clear. Certainly the Romans did successfully attack mighty fortresses. They do distribute much land at a price. They do control Egypt and Libya. However, not so much the Nubians. The Nubians, by the way, is modern Ethiopia. The best they really could do with the Nubians was get into a non-aggression pact with them, but they never really controlled them. As for the end of the empire, it didn't really come by an attack from the king of the north and the king of the south. Depending on when you put the end of the empire, the end may have come from attacks from the east, and not just threats from the east. But again, the problem that people have with this part of the prophecy is that you would have to switch from talking about one king in the previous verses and then having the same noun, the king, suddenly refer to a group of individuals. As James Boyce says, since there are different opinions about what's going on in these verses, this makes a stronger likelihood that these verses are about the future. Because so much of the earlier part of the prophecy was so specifically fulfilled. In this case, the prophecy that Daniel records shows the limits of our human minds. Daniel is now looking far into the future, and Tremper Longman makes a very nice parallel that when John the Baptist prophesied about Jesus, he skipped right over his time on earth to focus on the last judgment. You remember, he sees Jesus and he hears a person bringing the winnowing fork in his hand. He doesn't say anything about his crucifixion or resurrection. And then he has to ask Jesus, was my prophecy correct? So I'm going to stick with the interpretation that the figure talked about in verses 36 to 45 is the Antichrist. But if you want to disagree with me, that's fine. We did hear. That's fine. So you're allowed. I keep telling my students, you're allowed to disagree with me. It's okay. We did hear about this figure in chapter 7. This is a figure who will appear at the end times, just before Jesus returns, to oppose the work of Jesus in the world. And in verse 40, the angel does talk about the end times, helping us to place this section in context. Now, in some ways, Antiochus is a weak reflection of the Antichrist. So we're kind of building up on these rulers and coming to the strongest one at the end. The Antichrist will be so proud that he will not only reject the God of Israel, he will even reject his own ancestral gods. This pride looks very much like the pride that Satan shows in Isaiah 14:12-14. He provokes violence. The entire world will be consumed by his war. The last war will take place between the sea and the glorious holy mountain, that is the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. Now it's possible that this is a reference to the Battle of Armageddon, which will take place outside on the plains outside of the city of Megiddo. And that, if geography, if you look at your map, you can think about that as being between Jerusalem and the Mediterranean Sea. The Antichrist does not understand, because he is so proud, that God makes and deposes kings, which Daniel himself had told us in 2:21. But we are hearing that there will be a violent end to human history. However, the comfort at the other end of it is, we know this ruler's kingdom will perish, just as all the other kingdoms will perish except the kingdom of God. For in verse 45, he shall come to his end with none to help him. So what's our practical takeaway from this chapter, which has thrust us deeply into the 3rd and 2nd centuries BC in the Mediterranean? The most important point to me is that God is the God who controls history. He laid out the events in Daniel in a clear and precise matter, excuse me, to Daniel, 300 to 400 years before they happened. And we can trace these events through the outside of the Bible sources to see that they occurred just as God had planned them. Daniel's words were meant to proclaim good news to an exiled people and comfort those who had returned to Jerusalem. Does that mean that we are all puppets in God's hands and that everything works out just the way he wants to and we can just kind of lay back and let it happen? I don't think so. Because we are told that Joseph's brothers were still responsible for acting in a murderous way by putting Joseph in the pit and selling him to slavers and even trying to kill him before that. Even if God meant Joseph to be sold into slavery so the people of Israel would be saved during a time of famine. Pharaoh was responsible for not letting the children of Israel go after Moses told him that was what God wanted. Judas was responsible for turning Jesus over to the authorities, even though Jesus knew he would. This is a great mystery to contemplate, but God does want us to act. We hear that the prayers of Moses and Abram changed God's mind, and certainly Daniel praying for the return to exiles by the bank of the Tigris River allowed him to comprehend the great cosmic forces at play beyond the things that he could see. God does have a plan. He has a plan for you. He has a plan for your family. He has a plan for your neighborhood. A plan for your city, for your nation, and for the world. Although it may look like the wicked are prospering right now, and their plans are successful, we haven't reached the end of the story. The end of the story, we will see the end of evil, and we will be able to live with God. We can live confidently, fearlessly, knowing that we are securely within the hands of a powerful God. So let's thank him for this reassurance. Our Father in heaven, we thank you that you are a God who makes and deposes kings and not an idol made with hands in which we place our trust. We thank you for this glimpse into the future that you gave Daniel, and we thank you that you have not left us alone to fight evil. We thank you mostly that you are the God of justice, and all evil will be given its true reward at the end of time. And while we wait for that day, we thank you for the mercy that you have shown us by sending your Son, so that we can live after the end of human history with you in the beautiful land. Amen.